Inner Voice, a heartfelt chat with Dr. Fujian.
Hello, everyone. I'm so excited to be with you today. Welcome to the Inner Voice Show. I'm Dr. Fujian Zain, and I have Sean in studio. This is a show about what matters most in our life, our minds, our thoughts, feelings, actions, friendships, and our fulfillment in this beautiful journey of life. In this show, I'll bring you the two of the latest research about telepathic communication might be closer to reality than you think. Wow. And second research, which is really interesting to me, is about cultural drive breeding war and a new evolutionary theory. I'm really excited to share these with you. Then I will speak to Dr. Stephen Nachmanovich. He is the author of The Art of Is. This is a great book and free play. So you can call us on the studio line, 951-922-3532, if you wanted to talk to me or Stephen. And be sure to listen to the podcast on iTunes, on Stitcher, and share it with your friends. Go and give me reviews, talk to me, send me emails, let me know what are the topics you want me to talk about. And I love to be able to hear from you and work with you directly. And we'll be right back with the tip of the week.
Hello, I'm Dr. Fujian, and I have great news for you. I'm offering a special time-limited offer to anyone who's interested in online therapy or coaching sessions. I've developed the awareness integration model, which allows in only 12 weeks to raise your self-esteem and confidence and let go of your thoughts and emotions that produce depression and anxiety for you. So call today to schedule your online session and save $600. Call me today at 818-648-2140. That's 818-648-2140. Or go to www.fujian.com.
So this week, I've been working on the concept of being curious and interested. Yeah, curious and interested. This week, I've worked with so many people that lost their interest in their relationship, in their marriages, in the people they live with, careers, jobs, any friendships, with people in totality, and some even with their life. So how does one lose interest? Have you lost interest in something or someone? How do you lose interest? Now, some lose interest due to feeling uncomfortable or they're anxious, angry, feeling hurt, shame, or guilt in that area. So maybe in their relationship, they feel anxious and angry at someone, or they're hurt by someone, and they're like, I'm just not interested. Some lose interest because all is well, but not challenging enough. They're getting bored. And some lose interest when something more exciting shows up. But certainly, when the interest is gone, the juice, the passion, and mostly the wonder of curiosity will be gone in that area or in that type of a relationship. And again, sometimes in totality of life, like if it goes away in different types of relationships, the accumulation of that is like, all right, I'm done. So how can you keep your interest going on in your work and relationships in life? Realizing that every minute is new, because it's true. Every minute is new. When you're engaging fully with people and activities, you will experience the relationship fully. You will be present, engaging, and engrossed with all that shows up, waiting for the next moment, curious about the next moment in wonder and awe. So being curious and waiting for the newness, even though it appears that day after day it is similar, looking for the differences, looking for the creation of something new today within the same structure, creates an excitement which keeps you curious, leading to being interested. If you, instead of going to your mate and thinking, I know what he's going to say, or I know what he's going to, I'm just going to go home and it's the same thing. Everything's going to be the same. I'll go tomorrow at work and it's the same thing. And if you come back home and you're mate, how was your day? Same thing. So if you're looking at similarities and sameness, then you're going to get bored. But if every day you look at something that was new for you, then the curiosity will continue and you will keep your interest. Live as if every moment is new and filled with the potentiality of a new creation, because it is. We'll be right back with the research.
Join the conversation every Monday afternoon at 3 p.m. Pacific for Inner Voice Heartfelt Chat with Dr. Fujian. Dr. Fujian is a radio and TV host, international speaker, psychotherapist, life coach, and the author of Life Reset, The Awareness Path to Create the Life You Want. She brings you the latest research and interviews with experts in the field of cognitive sciences. Anyone who loves to grow and create growth for humanity gets a voice on this call-in show. Inner Voice Heartfelt Chat with Dr. Fujian. Monday afternoons at 3 p.m. Pacific on Smart Talk KMET 1490 AM and on KMET1490AM.com.
So I got to tell you about this research. I got to tell you a story before I tell you this research. I remember when I was a teenager and I was in a boarding school in Arizona, Jesuit school. And my roommate and I used to, and I remember she used to love this person. And we used to sit there and think telepathically. We could tell her lover to love her. And we sat there every night, really concentrating for the person she really loved to love her back. Just telling you, that didn't work. So when I saw this new research, I'm like, hey, maybe we weren't that off. Didn't work, maybe for other reasons. But hey, our telepathic influence might have tried to work. So the latest research about telepathic communication might be one step closer to reality, thanks to a new research from University of Washington. A team created a method that allows three people to work together to solve a problem using only their mind. In BrainNet, three people play a Tetris-like game using a brain-to-brain interface. This is the first demonstration of two things: a brain-to-brain network of more than two people and a person being able to both receive and send information to others using only their brain. The team published its result April 16th in the Nature Journal Scientific Reports. So humans are social beings who communicate with each other to cooperate and solve problems that none of us can solve on our own. The researchers wanted to know if a group of people could collaborate using only their brains. That's how they came up with the idea of BrainNet, where two people help a third person solve a task. As in Tetris, the game shows a block at the top of the screen and a line that needs to be completed at the bottom. Two people, the senders, can see both the block and the line, but can't control the game. The third person, the receiver, can see only the block, but can tell the game whether to rotate the block to successfully complete the line. Each sender decides whether the block needs to be rotated and then passes that information from their brain through the internet into the brain of the receiver. Then the receiver processes the information and sends a command to rotate or not rotate the block to the game directly from their brain, hopefully completing and clearing the line. The team asked five groups of participants to play 16 rounds of the game. For each group, all three participants were in different rooms and couldn't see, hear, or speak to one another. The senders each could see the game displayed on a computer screen. The screen also showed the word yes on one side and the word no on the other side. Beneath yes, there was an LED flashes of 17 times per second, and beneath no, there was an option of an LED flashing 15 times a second. So once the sender makes a decision about whether to rotate the block, they send yes or no to the receiver's brain by concentrating on the corresponding light, only concentrating on the light. The senders wore caps that picked up electrical activity in their brains. The light's different flashing patterns trigger unique types of activity in the brain, which the caps can pick up. So as the sender stared at the light for their corresponding selection, the cap picked up those signals, and then computer provided real-time feedback by displaying a cursor on their screen that move toward their desired choice. The selections were then translated into a yes or no answer that could be sent over the internet to the receiver. To deliver the message to the receiver, they use the cable that ends up with a wand that looks like a tiny racket behind the receiver's head. This coil stimulates the part of the brain that translates signals from the eye. They essentially trick the neurons in the back of the brain to spread around the message that they have received signals from the eyes. Then, participants have the sensation that bright arcs or objects suddenly appear in front of their eyes. If the answer was yes, rotate the block. Then the receiver would see the bright flash. If the answer was no, then the receiver wouldn't see anything. So the receiver received input from both senders before making a decision about whether to rotate the block. Because the receiver also wore a cap, they used the same method as the senders to select yes or no. The senders got a chance to review the receiver's decisions and send corrections if they disagreed. Then once the receiver sent the second decision, everyone in the group found out if they cleared the line. On average, each group successfully cleared the line 81%, 81% of the time, with 13 out of 16 trials. That is huge. So based on reading this data, I got it why when I was a teenager, it didn't work. We just didn't have the cap. We were trying to do it with no other vehicle but brain. So now I guess technology is bringing the cap so that there's some tool that could translate and go in between human to human. So that was the first research. I'm going to tell you about the second research. You know, I've been constantly thinking about how come when everything appears that as the world goes forward and we're all cooperating, all is well, things are better, we have a global economy, we're really trying to cooperate with each other, and then suddenly, you know, conflict arises out of nowhere and things appear that we're going about 2,000 years back. So this question was always arising for me. And then I saw this research today and it was really interesting. So I want to share that with you. When anthropologists consider the origins of warfare, their evolutionary theories tend to boil it down to the resource scarcity trifecta of food, territory, and mates. Three resources that would justify the loss of life and risk to a warring group of hunter-gatherers. But researchers from University of Colorado, Denver University of British Columbia, and University of Santiago, Chile, created an evolutionary mathematical model to underneath a fourth theory. They found that acculturation, the adaptation and limitation of the victor's culture following defeat, could promote the evolution of intergroup conflicts. In other words, groups may evolve to fight for fighting's sake, despite the costs. The study, Acculturation Drives the Evolution of Intergroup Conflict, was published June 21st in the Journal of PNAS. Warriors and Shepherds in Human Revolution, researchers researched the evolution of cooperation and altruism, paradoxes in the conventional evolutionary theory of survival of the fittest, by group selection. But in this case, they wanted to understand the evolution of intergroup conflicts. The researchers' mathematical model is based on two classes of people, warriors who specialize in intergroup conflicts and have a low birth rate, and shepherds who cannot defend themselves but are highly reproductive. The amount of each within a group depended on the probability that an offspring becomes a warrior or a shepherd, a cultural trait passed vertically from one generation to the next. The study determined group dynamics through three types of events: group extinction, a whole group dies as a result of a drought or a bad crop; fissions, when an overly large group splits into two; and group conflicts due to belligerence, assumed to increase a group's probability of trying to conquer another group. When groups fight in the model, the winner imposes its cultural traits on the loser or eliminates the group altogether. The belligerence of the group and the probability that they will impose their culture, acculturation tendency, are two of those traits. You need individuals who are shepherds to reproduce and individuals who are warriors to protect the group. But the right number of each can change over time in complicated and surprising way. So cultural evolution may promote the spread of conflict. How might these cultures thrive or die? Depending on the initial conditions of each group and which parameters, like acculturation and belligerence, were allowed to evolve, researchers found that sometimes groups fought each other into extinction. In other cases, the whole population reached this peaceful equilibrium. But when researchers allowed all of the parameters to evolve, they found that acculturation co-evolved with belligerence and warrior production. In other words, groups became more and more belligerent over time, and they forced their cultures on their victims instead of killing them. That culture evolution may promote the spread of conflict, even in cases where it may hurt both the groups and individuals, is a theory that has received little attention. A mathematical model was one way to see how it could happen. Researchers realized mathematical anthropology sounds like an oxymoron. Most people who theorize about why there is so much conflict between human groups use economic and political science. But when you look at a hunter-gatherer society with a mathematical model which forces you to state your assumptions precisely, the results can be enlightening. They caution that the causes of today's conflicts are much too complex for a mathematical model to just tackle on its own. But this research is a glimpse into how imitation might indirectly breed conflict in evolutionary theory. And it may actually answer some of the questions that show up. Why now? Why are these happening? And how come these conflicts are arising out of the blue again? So now I'm excited to introduce to you Dr. Stephen Nachmanovich, who's an author of The Art of Is. This is a great book, by the way. I read it. It's really, he has a beautiful way with words, improvising as a way of life. So he performs and teaches internationally as an improvisationalist, violinist. I'm saying this all wrong. Internationally as an improvisational violinist, lecturer, workshop leader, and multimedia artist. He holds degrees from Harvard and the University of California. His work spans many fields, exploring the spiritual and social underpinnings of art. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back with Dr. Stephen Nachmanovich.
Have you ever wished you could just wake up one day, reach across your nightstand, and hit the life reset button? Let's face it, the struggles and frustrations of everyday life leave millions of women and men around the globe yearning for a new way. And the new way is right here in Life Reset, the awareness integration path to create the life you want by Dr. Fujian Zane. You can get it now at Fujian.com or Amazon.com. Life Reset, the awareness integration path to create the life you want. You deserve it.
Join the conversation every Monday afternoon at 3 p.m. Pacific for Inner Voice Heartfelt Chat with Dr. Fujian. Dr. Fujian is a radio and TV host, international speaker, psychotherapist, life coach, and the author of Life Reset, The Awareness Path to Create the Life You Want. She brings you the latest research and interviews with experts in the field of cognitive sciences. Anyone who loves to grow and create growth for humanity gets a voice on this call-in show. Inner Voice Heartfelt Chat with Dr. Fujian. Monday afternoons at 3 p.m. Pacific on Smart Talk KMET 1490 AM and on KMET1490AM.com.
Hello, I'm Dr. Fujian, and I have great news for you. I'm offering a special time-limited offer to anyone who's interested in online therapy or coaching sessions. I've developed the awareness integration model, which allows in only 12 weeks to raise your self-esteem and confidence and let go of your thoughts and emotions that produce depression and anxiety for you. So call today to schedule your online session and save $600. Call me today at 818-648-2140. That's 818-648-2140. Or go to www.fuzhan.com.
Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dr. Fuzhan Zain, and I'm so excited to have Dr. Stephen, I've got to tell you, Nachmanovich. Did I say it right?
Yes.
Yay! Welcome to my show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
How are you?
I'm fine.
Wonderful. I love this book. I really love the way you put words together. That is an amazing way. The way you put words together, it's an art. So tell me about why you named your book Art of Is.
Ah, well, first of all, I didn't name it The Art of Is. My son did.
Oh, good. How come?
Yeah. He's an extraordinary poet, Jack Nachmanovich. But, you know, I'm interested in improvisation, or improvising rather. I'm interested in the art that people create together spontaneously when they allow themselves to listen to each other and pay attention. Mm-hmm. So you are in front of me through an electronic medium, and I'm in front of you, and we're talking. So this is the most ordinary improvised art form in the world, conversation.
Yes.
But I am responding to what you say, to who you is. And I've been asked many times about improvising in a field. I mean, it's one thing for me to stand up with a violin on stage and improvise music, and not many people do that. But people do analogous things in all sorts of art forms. In medicine, for example, improvising means paying attention to the person who is in front of you at the moment, rather than the chart or a textbook case. Doctors often talk about treating the patient, not the chart. Okay, relating to the situation in our lives, relating to the disabilities we may have, relating to the difficulties we may have, the obstacles in our work, the political insanity around us, all of these kinds of things. You can do the most imaginative and most direct work by realizing what is in front of you. So it's really, there's a way in which improvising seems like, you know, a sort of very fancy imaginative art form, but actually you are seeing what is there and responding to it. And that's why it's The Art of Is.
You wrote this right at the beginning of the chapter, an improvisation by a small group of musicians is a microcosm of evolution. It grows from seemingly nothing, from what appears to be random elements of the environment, and self-organizes into a distinctive event with its own shape, with feelings and relevance. A leaderless ensemble cooperates, exchanging signals of give and take, stimulus and response, mutual respect and playfulness. I love this, mutual respect and playfulness. Yes. No one is giving directions, yet people find the way to come together in a clear and compelling pattern of action, paying exquisite attention to each other. They find form and refine its development. They invent a language and a culture from the ground up. It's almost like watching kids play.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And watching artists play, I mean, it's very similar. You know, many people have said, and I said in my earlier book, Free Play, how the activity of a mature artist has something to do with returning to the state of being a kid, but with the knowledge and experience and difficulties you have encountered as an adult, and being able to play through that. Mm-hmm. And certainly the experience of artists working together in some way, or people in any field collaborating and paying attention to each other and creating something new, is essentially a recovery of what we had as kids. Paying attention to each other, playing, pushing boundaries, feeling the other people who are pushing boundaries around you, discovering the new boundaries. You know, it's all there in the dynamic of little children playing. But for us to recover that as adults is really an extraordinary job.
And it brings passion again into life, the interest, the awe. And it's what I was, as I, you were talking, I'm like, well, what would block it is almost like a fear and ego and attachment to something that it may not necessarily be feasible. And then yet when they let go of that attachment, let go of that fear and the ego, suddenly you become alive with this in-betweenness. I remember, I don't know if you know him or not, Dr. Daniel Siegel, do you know him? He wrote a book. And in his latest work, one was The Mind, and then the latest one, Aware, he talked about putting me and we together, mimwe. And he talks about this in-between concept, which is I'm also hearing you when you come out of yourself and you play in between. This is it's a space out here that you're not stuck to here. But as you come here, then it develops. That's where you improvise and that's who your creativity becomes you.
Yes, I think that's very true. It's also true that to be able to do that, to become, to sort of merge into some connection like that with other people, means that you do actually have to have a me established. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's many people who think that, well, you can just let go of all boundaries and just dissolve, and that's a sure way to psychosis.
Yes.
So, people and people have often confused artistic practice with psychosis, but believe me, they're not the same thing. And it's this constant. I think you used the word liminal or hinted at it. You know, the sense of playing through and across boundaries. So yes, children play with each other. But yes, at the same time, they're developing a strong ego and developing a sense of who he or she is. And adults, to be able to play with each other and let go of that ego, have to have some ego established in the first place in order to let go of it. So you're constantly wiggling across that boundary or those many boundaries. And it's that play across boundaries that unites us in our work.
And same thing that you, for example, as a musician, you need to know how great you can play the violin, another person, the trumpet, they need to know really greatly the art of what they're doing and then not get restricted about what they're doing and play, bringing what they're already great at into the play. And the same kind of analogy goes with what you were talking about, the ego. Like, you have to know who you are and the sense of your own boundary and then not get stuck with it and then just allow that to play and be open.
Yeah. Now, I did have what you're saying reminds me of an episode that I had a number of years ago. I was teaching workshops at Arizona State University in their School of Music. Mm-hmm. And I hosted by my friend Sam Palafian, who is a tuba player of extraordinary abilities. And so we were sitting in the center of about 150 college students who all had their instruments. And I'm a person, I've never gotten a sound out of a wind instrument in my life. I mean, I just can't do it. It's ridiculous to try. So at one point, a young woman raises her hand in the class, and she asks a question that many people have often asked, which is, if you have become really skilled at the instrument or art form or tool that you've practiced for years, can that get in the way of playing freely. And how do you get over that? And of course, it can get in the way. It's another one of these boundary conditions that we were just talking about. In order to play at all, you have to learn how to play well, and that requires practice. But then the practice can trap you in your fixed idea of how things are supposed to be. Mm-hmm. And anyway, so she asked this question, and I answered, well, sometimes it helps to play on an instrument that you have no skill at whatsoever. So Sam Palafian immediately lifted up his enormous tube. He was pointing at me. I had a viola, I think, at that point. And he said, have you ever played this? No. Well, I've never played one of those. So he made me put my money where my mouth is. And so with this audience of 150 students, he played viola and I played tuba, and we played together. And of course, the sounds that I got were certainly not expert sounds. However, we connected with each other, and it was really pretty interesting. Yeah. And it was a lot of fun. So very often you get challenged like that, and that makes for jumps and leaps. Yeah. And
It's an amazing experience to be beside musicians who are playing and doing this kind of a communication that goes back and forth. And the improvising at that moment of whatever shows up is just, you know, it's a felt experience that shows up, and it goes beyond those musicians. It just fills the air. Like, it brings everyone into that moment. And the experience of here and now, present moment, waiting for the next moment to appear, to emerge out of whatever it is, because it's almost like the whole room has no idea, even the musician have no idea what is the next thing that shows up. And there's right. this beauty, and I've seen that also as, you know, the analogy of communication, of people sitting together and brainstorming, just waiting for the next word, for the next idea to show up, and the whole room is waiting for that brainstorming. And those are usually moments that as human beings we feel truly elated, we feel alive because of this allowance that we give each other.
Yes, exactly. I mean, there's this sense of, again, in my previous book Free Play, I have a chapter called Disappearing, which is about this experience, you know, that to make art appear, you have to disappear. And there's that sense of flowing, whether you're playing by yourself or with other people. When it's really happening, you are, in a sense, you're in a place where there isn't a separate you. Mm-hmm. And you are disappearing, your skills are disappearing, and at the same time, they're present. Yes. And to be able to be both present and completely beyond yourself is a wonderful, wonderful state. And of course, we can't do it all the time.
Right.
There are times to come down to practicalities and take care of business. But when these moments happen, they are exquisite.
You wrote, art is the act of balancing, knowing what to prepare, what to leave to the moment, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Yes.
And you also talk about why it's important for us to live our own personal, artistic and creative lives. And why is that so important? Can you talk about that?
Oh, yes. I mean, first of all, the art of balancing, again, you know, I'm simultaneously in the art of is addressing the experience of artists and the experience of everyone. Because every activity, every craft, every profession, cooking, whatever it may be, can be practiced as an art. And every art form, whether it be cooking or music or law or whatever, is an act of balancing. It's an act of finding extremes, finding how far you can go this way, how far you can go this way, and allowing them to mix together in some way. You, just as like you and I are both sitting in rooms on opposite sides of the continent, but we're both doing the same thing. We're sitting on chairs. And that's an extraordinary act, okay, because it seems like we're doing nothing, okay? When I'm talking, you're doing nothing. When you're talking, I'm doing nothing. But actually, to sit up, you know, I could be like keeling over to the left side, and I've got muscles that know to pull me back to the right, and I could be keeling over to the right side, and I've got muscles that pull me back to the left. And this actually is how we sit. I mean, these movements are usually microscopic, so we're not aware of them. And we think, well, I'm just sitting, you know. And that's why forms of meditation often, you know, in Zen, they talk about shikantaza, just sitting, okay. But to sit up, to breathe, to do all these incredibly mundane activities is actually an art form. And we get to experience the balance through those art forms of ordinary everyday activities like sitting and breathing. And we can carry that feeling of balance into whatever more difficult art we may practice.
So two things I'm hearing. One is there's so many different ways to practice, keep coming to the balance. And then the other one is there's so many ways in learning how to become more into the present moment. So yeah. coming back to the present. And that can also be partly with the practice of art, and it comes through art. So when you allow yourself to do that, it becomes part of just flowing and having that. And then you can bring that, it's almost like a reciprocal concept, like you bring that into art and then art gives it back to you, and then it just flows back and forth to it.
Yes, exactly.
In your book, you talk about the two terms, improvising versus improvisation, and you promote improvising as opposed to improvisation. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yes, I mean, that's improvising it's a verb in the present. I'm talking with you now. A little bit later, I won't be talking with you. If I'm writing, I'm writing. And if I'm not writing, I'm not writing. And however, if I think that I am a writer, a noun, rather than a verb, then when I'm not writing, I can think, oh my God, I have writer's block. I just can't do it today. And what's the therapy for my terrible pathology of writer's block? But actually, sometimes you're writing and sometimes you're not writing. Sometimes you're playing music and sometimes you're not playing music. Sometimes you're playing music that's fast and noisy, and sometimes you're playing music that's slow with a lot of silence in it. So all of these activities, driving, it's a verb, okay? And as soon as we start to attach, I used to talk about improvisation, and so improvisation became the antidote to, let's say, composed music and the fixed scripted activity, even though, of course, I love composed music too. But they aren't opposites. What they are is phases of human activity. So to learn to be a verb, you know, in that chapter, I talk about the most unlikely person to appear in this sort of book is the general and president Ulysses S. Grant, who in the 1880s, when he was dying of cancer, it was just a few days before he died, and he wrote a letter to his doctor saying that, you know, I know that what I am is not a noun. Mm-hmm. I am a verb, you know. And he realized, of course, death is a moment of, you know, serious change. And he realized that, you know, he was really spouting extraordinary philosophy in that moment. And so to actually cultivate the feeling of being a verb is really, really important. My mentor, Gregory Bateson, the anthropologist and philosopher, used to have a slogan, stamp out nouns, you know. And obviously, when we're talking to each other, it's fine to use nouns, and we can't really talk without them. But to regard nouns, to regard person, place, thing, idea as provisional, as ways of seeing a changing process in the moment, is okay. But to regard things as being hard, permanent objects, you know, an improvisation can become an object. You can sell an improvisation. You can sell a method of improvisation. You can sell creativity as a commodity, and that's often done. And what I'm interested in is the opposite of that.
Mm-hmm. You wrote, what can we learn from improvising? There are some things we can leave behind, including the fixed idea of self as a sack with certain contacts. Qualities of interaction are not things we possess. They're activities that we manifest in a particular place and time. We can see people without captions. We can allow music to unfold without attaching labels to it. We can allow our own stories to play out in the complex reality of life. So you shift life and all there is into it out of a concept of object into an action-oriented present moment where it has openness and potentiality to be anything that it can be. And that's what I'm sensing from what you're saying.
Exactamente.
Got it. Now, yes. Again, this part really caught me, and I loved it, where you had talked about many times when it's like this instantaneous, just share, say what comes out of your mouth, because this is important in this era, which you wrote, you know, you just don't open, you know, you do. Open up your mouth and as if, okay, I'm just being honest. I'm just being myself. I'm just telling the truth. I'm just going to say whatever I want. And those can be really detrimental. And you also wrote about this concept of being ethical with what you say, that there's the truth. It has some sense of an ethical concept within it. And you know, that's what also needs to be, it needs to be considered, which you wrote also the concept of mutual humanity, Ubuntu from South Africa, which is I'm a person through your being a person. And that concept of mutual respect of, when I want to play with you, playing means that we're equal, that we trust, you know, there has to be an element of trust there. There has to be an element of, you know, the desire to connect there. And for that, I also have to take the benefit and the goodness of both of us in what I say to be able to join with you versus just open my mouth and throw anything at you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Say more about that concept.
I can't help hearing when you talk about the negative side of people opening their mouths and just spouting whatever might be in them. It's hard
which we hear in media a lot right now.
Yes, well, we're hearing. Yes, I mean, I'm thinking that the current leader of the Republican Party is does a lot of this, but the issue, let's say with him and with the many people like him, is that it's not that there's something wrong with spontaneity and spontaneity reveals what you really think. The problem is that spontaneity does reveal what you really think.
Yeah.
And so we have to take that kind of honesty very, very carefully and at face value at the same time. I mean, dictators and demagogues of the past have generally said exactly what they think, and they haven't couched it in deceptive language. And so to make our way through this time, we have to see what is around us and what is scaring people and how much we need to change our way of seeing in order to address the terrible things that are brewing all around us. Mm-hmm. I mean, in the book, I talk about a lot of the experience that comes in the book from my time teaching artists of various kinds and other people, teachers, medical people, and so on, is in the really nice, safe space of the studio or the classroom, where people can come in and trust that even if they don't know that they've never met the people they're with, then for the next 2 hours they can be within a circle of support and be free and go to that childlike place that you alluded to before. But I talk in the last part of the book about a man I got to know near the time of his death, Herbert Zipper, who was a conductor and composer in Vienna in the early part of the 20th century. And the Anschluss came and he was thrown into Dachau. And he started creating clandestine concerts in the concentration camps behind the latrines in Dachau, writing music on scraps of junk paper, prisoners, slaves, singing and playing on junk instruments, with guards posted to make sure that the SS guards weren't coming so that they could disperse. So the freedom to act like this in a terrible time is extraordinary. And people like that, he went on to do other extraordinary things. But to be able to be free at a time when you are not free is really something. And it has just as much to do with this act of improvising as the more pleasant and ordinary act of people going into the studio together. And to go back to your initial question about the title, The Art of Is, to be able to make our way through perilous times doesn't involve pretending that those perilous times aren't happening. It means seeing what is in front of you and acting well in that context, acting ethically in that context.
And it seems like in a lot of the time of hardship or darkness or problems, that allowing your emotions and allowing your wishes and dreams and fantasies, or allowing to talk about what's going on through that type of an art, whether it's a written art, whether it's a performance art, whether it's through music or sound. I mean, I've heard the most amazing lyrics come out of the hard times, or the most amazing music, or visual arts to come out. And even in comedy, you know, bringing it into an art of improvising in comedy to release some of this pressure and light up, and even, you know, create kind of like allowing people to get up for their dreams. So this the allowance of art to work through and bring us out. You also talk about practice.
Yes.
There's some discipline in here. It isn't just letting go, but there's also some discipline around here.
There's a great deal of discipline in here. John Cage said that if you find it boring to do something for 2 minutes, then do it for four. And if you find it boring to do it for 4 minutes, do it for eight. And if you find it boring for 8 minutes, then do it for 16. And eventually you'll begin to see that it's really quite interesting. And the discipline of practice, of coming back to something over and over and over again, is really where all of this work comes from. I mean, you said at the beginning of this conversation, you said some very sweet things about my writing, as though it was, as though something just like flowed out of me, you know. But it wasn't like that at all. What it was like was taking, you know, thousands of paragraphs of junk and squeezing them and squeezing them and getting rid of things that I felt good about writing because they didn't fit. And this kind of remorseless, relentless practice of reduction and elimination that is the art of writing.
Yes, I did that last week. I went to Vegas to write my book for 1 week. I kind of just went, just write. And as this thing flowed and just flew, and then it was like, oh, I'm actually liking this. It's just coming out, you know, this is the first draft. This is not edited yet, but it was just this concept of allowing to write and the sharing of myself and hearing myself play out here. And it, you know, it has a different flow, but then it also took that practice of going away from my life and writing 12 hours in increments of, you know, being very disciplined, or that just wouldn't have even happened. So I really get what you're saying. So what is it and how is it to be a good improviser? Tell us.
Well, to be a good improviser doesn't mean impressing people with your technique, though, of course, it's great to have technique. It doesn't mean doing something that's all new, though sometimes it's great to do something that's all new. It means extending yourself in some way that you may not have extended yourself before, making discoveries that connect everything that you've done before with what you're doing now, and making discoveries that connect yourself to the context in which you live, near and far.
Beautiful. So if they could, in less than 1 minute, if they could take one thing out of this book, our audience and our listeners can take one thing, an idea away from reading your book, what would it be?
Everything changes. And to live comfortable with that constant change makes things really interesting. Yeah. And it maximizes your chance of doing interesting things in life.
Absolutely. So for everyone out there, please get the book, The Art of Is, The Improvising as a Way of Life by Dr. Stephen Nachmanovich. Thank you so much for being on my show. And for everyone out there, create an amazing life. Create it for yourself and everyone around you. And I'll see you next week. Bye-bye.